Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's science. It does sound woo-woo, but there is science that backs up how all your neuroelectric pathways can get rewired through visualization, because your brain actually does not know the difference between reality and a thought. Like, I mean, it just, you know it is, but if you were to show your brain the exact same thing, like, it absorbs it as the same way. I don't think that it gets talked about as much as it could. I think you're right. You're like, oh, I'll take care of that on my long run. Or they let their daily habits and attitudes slip. And then they think that they're just going to have all this stuff dialed in on race day. And it's like, if you have a screw-it attitude or a negative attitude, if something happens and you don't immediately start going to problem solving, because that's all ultra running is, it is problem solving. And so race day comes and things start happening, and they just freeze and they don't know what to do. You know, a lot of those stressful situations trigger our fight, flight, or freeze. And I feel like in order to be successful in ultra running, or for it to not be as traumatic, you've got to have a lot of, you know, fight response rather than quitting.
Hey, welcome back to the Ultramarathon Mindset Podcast, where we talk about what it takes to go the distance in running and in life. I'm your host, Eric Dieter. I'm an ultramarathon runner and a mindset coach. When trail runners get together to run a few miles, we never know where the conversation is going to go. So if you're ready, let's get started. My guest this week is Becca Jones. Becca is an ultramarathon runner. She's a coach. She is also the race director of the Mid-State Mile, a last man standing race, and the Tennessee Mile. She has a lot of good experiences and stories and insights to share. I hope you enjoy this conversation with Becca Jones. Well, welcome back. This is our second try to get this episode with you, Becca. I would like to give a little bit about who you are and how you got started running.
So I am a running coach and one of the co-RDs for Mid-State Mile, Tennessee Mile. I got started running back in high school. I did track and cross country and found my way to ultras probably about 6-7 years ago, I guess now. And fell in love with that whole sport, just the challenge, the, you know, just the adventure of it all. So ultra running is very much who I am as a person. I think it was what I was meant to do. I'm not saying I'm going to be a professional or anything, but it's very much in alignment with my purpose here on this earth. So
what was the thing that kind of because, I mean, that's not something, I mean, I think there are a lot of people who kind of made a gradual, you know, 5K, doing that for a while, and then half, you know, kind of worked their way up, and you kind of said, like, well, once I discovered ultra marathons, this is my thing. So what was it that...
So I didn't really do anything after high school. I bartended. I worked restaurant industry for like 16 years, managing bars and slinging drinks. And I was day drinking with like my best friend's brother, and he said he wanted to do an ultra marathon for his birthday. And he's like, you gonna do it with me? And I was like, yeah, that sounds like super freaking cool. Let's do it. And keep in mind, like, I ran like maybe 4 or 5 miles a couple of times a week for fitness. So I was like, how far is that? And he's like, 31 miles. And I was like, what the crap? That's really freaking far. I was like, yeah, you know, let's do it. I didn't run 5Ks. I didn't run road marathons. I think the furthest I had ever ran was maybe 10 miles back in high school, you know? So mm-hmm. I didn't do running, so to speak. But, you know, he was like, it's trail. Like, we looked at stuff and it just looked so cool from a distance. So automatically, I'm like, I love being in the woods. That's just my happy place. So it just seemed to fit. And, you know, he ended up moving away, but I found a local training group and trained with them and ran my first 50K. So I kind of found my way into it in a very unconventional way.
Yeah. Well, you know, and a lot of, there are a lot of memes and stories about runners who, you know, have had a few drinks and find out that they've signed up for another ultramarathon. So you, that was your, when you said, yeah. We were sitting around day drinking, I'm like, usually whatever comes after that, it's like, yeah, that's a trail runner story.
Yes, pretty much. I can say we are guilty of talking to people into some ultras after a couple beers, for sure.
Yeah, I know there's, that's, I think trail runners have a reputation of drinking alcohol, you know, that, but,
yeah, it definitely seems to go hand in hand.
And I have been trying to figure out, I mean, there's, speaking of that, why trail runners, Fireball is a thing among trail runners. You know, I was not much of a drinker when I got into this sport, and then it's like, there's Fireball at the aid stations, and I'm thinking, this is different.
Yeah, I think it's because it's so easy to shoot, you know? I mean, people want something that they can drink that numbs the pain, that's a little bit of a party atmosphere. Not everyone wants to chug a beer, so, right. Yeah. You know, I think Fireball's pretty palatable. It really steps up to the plate and says, ah, you want something you can do hot or cold, carry it with you, mm-hmm. Set it on the table.
Yeah, it's just, yeah, this, I went to War Eagle, and at the registration, when they were giving, you know, when you registered, he says, here, you know, a shot of Fireball. And it's just like, wow. It just, as a fairly newcomer. I mean, I've only been doing ultras for, you know, 4 years. That was something that surprised me. It's like, I just didn't kind of expect it, 'cause I don't think road people are doing that kind of thing. So.
No, I think they're a little bit more serious. You know, I think we're a little bit more for the action-packed, fun-time adventure sort of deal. So I think alcohol falls a little bit more into that category as opposed to being glued to your watch and super like, oh, it's going to dehydrate me. We're like, no, that's great. This is perfect. I haven't had water in 3 hours. I'll drink 3 shots of Fireball.
Yeah. Yeah, unfortunately, I think some of the runners they DNF sometimes with that too. But yeah, water's good.
Yeah.
So you ran your first ultramarathon, and more came from that. What was kind of your progression? Your first 50K. What was that like?
You know, it was really hard. I ran with a friend, and you know, I had only had a 20-mile run prior to that, like obviously some training, but nothing long. I realized there was a lot more that we needed to dial in. Like, it took me as a shock how slow going those later miles are and how we run way too fast in training. You know, you run for 2 or 3 hours and it's just, you're not going to be running that fast after 6 or 7. I think it took us like 8 hours for like the first one, something like that. So when I was done, I didn't even want to drink my beer. I was in so much pain and so, I mean, I had a blast, but I was super ready to be done. Mm-hmm. It was like a looped course. So oh, wow. I was counting it down.
How many loops?
I don't even remember. I think it may have been like 8 loops or something. Wow, okay, like that. Yeah.
So short but, loops. Short loops are harder.
Yeah, it was, and it was super fun. It was in like the Southeastern Trail Series. It was a great time, but man, my legs were just so toast after that. And I progressed and did a couple more 50Ks. I found I really like the mountainous stuff. The more hiking and like less running involved, I was way more into that. So the harder the better. I did like BFC, I think, and another really tough 50K down in Georgia. And then after that, I did a couple 40-mile runs, 100K, and then I towed the line of my first 200-mile attempt and ran my first 100-miler in a 200-mile attempt. All within about a year.
All within a year. Okay, so you jumped in pretty heavy.
Yeah. So it may have been just over a year, but it wasn't by much.
So what was your 200-mile race that you were?
My first attempt at 200 was the Bigfoot. So
okay.
Definitely not an entry-level race at all. But
well, and that's in Oregon, isn't it?
Washington.
Washington State. Washington State. Yeah. So real mountains, not...
It was my first time out west. Like, it was, I think, my first time really even running on the other side of the Mississippi River. And I went out there by myself. No crew, no pacers, nothing. I ran 131 miles. I tore the tendon on the top of my foot around mile 80. So everything slowed down tremendously and was incredibly painful. Like, it was painful anyways. It was mm-hmm. the first time I ran that far, but it definitely made it a much more intense experience.
Yeah.
Not being able to move your foot for 50 miles.
Yeah. You tore it?
Yeah.
How do you tear the tendon on top of your foot? I mean, I irritated mine. I didn't get my shoes loose enough, and so I had it inflamed, and that hurts like hell. But
that's initially what I thought it was, because they were like, you know, is it there? And come to find out, I was not the only one that ended up with a really bad injury from like this section. And it happened to a buddy of mine too, like running Ball State. Like it's super doable. It's very rare. It's not very common. But there was a long section of these really rutted out dirt bike trails. I mean, mm-hmm. barely as wide as my foot at some points. And I have a small foot. I'm 4'11". Like, I have a size 6.5 foot. So, but the rocking and like back and forth of that, just, I eventually got like little tiny tears in it. Some of the ruts would be a foot or foot and a half deep. Some of them would be just a few inches, and there was just no good place to step. So it somehow at some point I remember it just getting like from hurting to a really sharp, excruciating pain that just burned and burned. And no matter what I did with my foot, it just, downhills made me just about throw up in my mouth. It hurt so bad.
Yeah. I felt like somebody stuck a knife in the top of my foot.
Yeah.
I just,
so. I could see that. And that's a painful place to have any sort of inflammation. You know, you don't realize how much your foot moves right there until
right?
it hurts to move it.
Yeah. Yeah. And
you know, driving for me after that was awful.
Oh, so it was your right foot?
Yeah.
So how long did it take to heal?
It took probably about 2 to 3 months fully. I did not take any of that time off. I should have. I just taped my foot all the time where it wouldn't move mm-hmm. and just kind of kept rolling from there. I learned to run with it like that. You know, I ran a few more races. The hardest part was like if I sat in a bar stool at work up high and then would have to get back down, like it would take me probably about 10 to 15 steps before I could actually start walking again
mm-hmm.
because it would just, I don't know, it would like go numb. It was a whole weird thing that it would do. But once I got up and going, I was fine. But if I stopped, then my foot didn't want to work again.
So the big thing is, and I've learned, is take care of your feet when you're, that's mm-hmm. a very, very important thing to do when you're out there. Foot care is a very necessary strategy.
Oh, it's number one. That's part of why I run in sandals. You know, I wear ultras if I'm wearing shoes, but I run in Tevva sandals, braces.
In Tevas, okay.
Yeah.
So do Tevas have an arch?
No.
They don't. Okay.
They do not.
Okay, I was.
But I do a lot of like barefoot running, anyways, training in, you know, flat sandals, so it doesn't
right.
it doesn't bother me.
See, my first sandals was zero, the DIY zeros, yep. and then switched. I got those didn't protect from rocks enough, so I got Lunas, and then now I've got a pair of Bedrocks.
Oh yeah, Bedrocks are great. I also train in the zero shoes. I ran Cruel Jewel 100 the first time in those, and I said never ever again. I mean, that was the most awful decision I could have ever made.
because of the minimalist, or just because of the design of the shoe?
Yeah, there was just no cushion. And, you know, after I took forever to run it the first time. It was close to like 41 hours, I think. It was just way too long. And my feet were just so beat up. I was stuffing my socks like underneath the arches, like trying to get padding underneath my feet like because it was just so awful. At one point, my friend took her inserts like out of her shoes and we slid them underneath my feet so that I could have a little more cushion.
So were you running in the Zero Mesa?
We were improvising.
Were you running in the Mesa Trail?
Oh, yes, I think so. I don't remember. I know I've got the shoes, but, and I only wear them from training. I don't know which ones they are anymore.
Yeah, that would be, how long had you been training with Minimalist at that point?
Probably a couple years at that point.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, but it was just the beating up and rocks and roots. It just, for almost, 40 hours of no cushion, it's just bad.
Yeah, your feet, it is a little bit different, especially if it's really, really rough.
Yeah, but the Tevas are awesome, and I love the sandals because I don't deal with blisters and my feet dry out, and they're just so cushy, and I can get 1,000 miles out of a $50 pair of sandals, so
yeah, that's the nice thing about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, my Lunas have 600 miles on them, and they're still, I can see a little bit of wear, but I'm like, oh yeah, they've got another 400 miles in them for sure. So
yeah, I looked at Lunas. I really, I almost went with them, but I was like, I went with something a little bit flatter, but initially I was like, $100 for sandals? These people are crazy. They're insane. I could pay $30 more and have something that fully protects my foot. Yeah. That was, my initial thoughts out the gate.
Right.
But,
yeah. But I enjoy sandals. I've been, the foot injury was the one that convinced me to switch over to sandals. And so, having the top of your foot hurt like that, I was like, no, I'm gonna learn how to run in sandals.
Yeah, it's a traumatizing experience. I don't recommend it for anyone. I'm glad you learned.
Yeah. So you ran Cruel Jewel again and were on podium, if I remember right.
Yeah. Yes, sir. Second place, and I took about 10 hours off my time. So big swing there.
So what was, I guess, besides, were you running in sandals on that one then?
Okay. I spent the first 22 miles in ultras just because I wasn't sure what condition the DRT was going to be in. We had a ton of rain this spring, and there had been some trails I'd run down in North Georgia that were super nice and cush, when wintertime was around, and then all the spring rains just really washed all that topsoil off, so I was like on some different trails. So I was cautious that first 22. I was like, I ended up breaking something in my foot the first Cruel Jewel. I was not aware at the time because everything hurt so bad it didn't matter. I didn't realize it till 2 days later. And I was like, I can't afford to nail anything out the gate. I need to protect my feet. So, shoes the first 20 miles, but then after that, Tevas.
Yeah. So what was kind of your strategy the second time? 10 hours is a significant time reduction. What was different?
The first time was so traumatizing because I screwed off so much and had so much downtime. I think I had 9 hours of downtime total. It was insane.
You mean like sitting around the aid stations or?
Yeah, sitting around and trying to sleep and get it was just, I didn't have good rest going in. And I was at two very different points in my life too when I towed the line. So, stress is stress is stress, and my body went in the first time just not really ready for what was going to happen to it. Second time was definitely different and much healthier, but the second time I only had 2 hours of downtime, but it was about 9 hours on that first one. And to be honest, it was so traumatizing. My whole thought process the second time was, it's not going to take a minute longer than it has to. I will not be on that course a second longer than I have to. I don't care what happens. I'm not stopping.
Well, and that's for, you know, most of us who, you know, if we end up taking too long or taking longer than we want, you know, a lot of times you can really have a lot of time sucked up in aid stations.
Oh yeah, 100%. You know, when a lot of people talk about trying to PR an ultra distance or take time off, the first place they need to look is their downtime. Your non-moving time is so wasted in the aid stations for sure. Even if you're like, oh, I moved in and out. Like, did you? Because you were there for 5 minutes and then you just did that five more times. So you almost sat around for half an hour, even if you weren't sitting.
Mm-hmm.
That's still almost 3 miles that you lost right there. So,
yeah. Yeah. And that's, and the thing that that I've wondered about is, have you done, well, you do this. I mean, you have a race that you sponsor at your house, the Murder Mile and the what's the Tennessee Mile.
So yeah, so it's Mid-State formats. Mile and Tennessee Mile.
Okay, not the Murder Mile. Yeah, somebody referred to it as a Murder Mile. So that's
that. Where I got the name. That is what we call it. We call the 1 mile loop the Murder Mile. Yeah. So you are mistaken on that, but yeah, Mid-State and Tennessee Mile on the Murder Mile.
Yeah. So I know you've kind of talked about that. What is the difference? I mean, the difference in mindset. I mean, we talked about getting in and out through aid stations and keeping moving. What do you have to do differently if you're on that kind of a course? Because you hit an aid station every mile in that.
Well, and so Mid-State, you know, we make everyone stop. So we have a 20-minute mile, but it's the whistle blows every 20 minutes. That's kind of like our hour, so to speak. Mm-hmm,
right.
You know, because it's not a traditional last man standing, and that's what Mid-State is the last man standing, or last person standing. Last man standing is just easier to say. Like, you know, it just flows better. It's no offense.
Yeah.
But
yeah, I know. It's interesting. The last man standing is becoming, I mean, I'm hearing that more, even from women. I mean, women are like, oh yeah, it's okay. You know,
yeah, it's a style of race. Yeah. And it's just kind of been that. You know, so I think ultra sign up, it used to say last man standing on ultra sign up, like for that style of event. And now they all say last person standing, but, yeah. So, you know, that's every 20 minutes that someone has to get up, and, you know, a 20 minute mile is easy until it's not. And that mile itself is 340 feet of elevation gain and loss in that 1.1 mile loop. And it's 340 feet. And the two climbs are both 20% grades, and that's it. They're straight up. We don't have any switchbacks. So it's a pretty intense little loop. And then for Tennessee Mile, you know, we just have timed events. We have like a 40-hour, a 24, a 12, an 8, and a 6. And it's, you really have to be careful on that one because people get pulled into stopping every loop. And it's like, you were just out there for 25 minutes or 13 or, you know, 16. We had a guy this year that he was going after the course record in the 24, and he was like stopping and taking like anywhere from 45 seconds to a minute at his like little stop. And we're like, hey, you just need to stop every two or three loops, man. It's a mile. He's like, oh yeah. But we get so programmed,
yeah.
To, you came into our crew. We're at an aid station. We have to stop. We got to stop. No, you don't. Just keep running.
Yeah.
I'll see you in 10 more minutes.
Yeah.
You'll be fine. Yeah. So on that one, you really have to be intentional about planning your stops every two or three loops. But Mid-State, you have to stop. So, you know, you got to figure out if you require some more downtime to, like, get your calories and your water and cool off, or if you want to, like, ride that line of coming in with like a minute left, just grab it and going. So
yeah,
don't think we found the perfect strategy yet.
Now the last man standing, the Tennessee Mile, not the Tennessee, which the Mid-State Mile,
yeah.
Race is it, I remember you did that the first year. You had some you had a pretty good competition between Chad Wright and can't remember the other guy.
Greg Armstrong,
yeah.
Yeah.
So is trying to remember, has just been one time, or is that have you had that one again?
We had it again this year, and this year Greg went to, I think he was in top five or six. I think Greg actually might have been in fourth or fifth. Anyways, so he was in there for a while, I think still just shy of 100. And then last time they were both shy of 100, it was like 98 or 96 miles, something like that. This year we had Luke and Chad go back and forth, and they went for 122 miles and 38 hours.
Okay.
So it was really, really long and intense. They were the only two people that hit 100 miles, and we had another really good friend, Aaron Dana. He made it to, I think, 91 or 92 miles. And so that's just, you know, about 30 hours in, or a little over, maybe under 30 at that point. But it's 3 miles an hour, and then we do a 20-minute intermission every couple of hours, so we give them a break.
Oh,
because, you know, traditional last man.
No, they get a break in what point?
Every 12 hours, every 12 they get a 20-minute break.
Okay.
Yeah, the traditional last man's, you know, they switch over to a road loop at night, and we don't do that. We stay on the same course. Mm-hmm. So we figured we have to give them some sort of a break so that they can hold on, rest, reset, and, you know, also get ready for the daytime and get ready for the nighttime. So those breaks fall right before it gets dark and right before the sun comes up, or right after it comes up. So, you know, it's a really good strategically for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I remember that the traditional last man standing, or at least you know, Lazarus's Big's backyard, the road loop at night. Yeah, that does give them kind of a little bit of a break from the, you know, from the mm-hmm. trails. A little bit, they can usually run that faster, I would imagine. So.
Yeah, they run it a little bit faster. You know, it's less up and down, so they can come back and get a nap and rest up a little bit, right. But we do not offer that. So,
well, yeah, you, with a 1 mile trail, you are kind of limited.
Yeah. There's a road right there, and it's rural country. Like, we could do it, but, and you know, we initially kicked it around, but I was like, man, that's just asking for somebody to get hit. I couldn't do it. So we stuck with that and made it work.
Yeah. That would be a lot more liability if somebody.
Yes.
And you know, if you can't, especially if you can't close the road, if you could close the road, you know, for that time, I would imagine that you could do it.
Yeah. And there's a real dangerous curve right there. As you come into like my parents' barn lot, like right before their house, coming from the opposite direction that we would come. Cause if you go up the road out from the course, it's super flat for a good ways. Like, it would be great for it. Just uber flat. You can have a nice flat loop.
Mm-hmm.
But that turn is just so, so blind and so gnarly for any car that's got any sort of speed to it. We're like, we can't do that.
So how did you, so you have a race director for two races, and then you're also a running coach. How did you get started in, I mean, what led to, first of all, what led you to be a running coach, and then what led you to, like, I think we're going to start a race at our place.
So the race, because the race really changed the trajectory of our entire lives, that whole, all of it. So, you know, COVID hit, shut everything down, and everyone pretty much took to the parks to, like, get out of their house and escape their families or bring their families and their dogs. You know, we were always at the park, so training with our friends and stuff, it became just impossible to get any long runs done out there because the trails were so crowded by the time we were finishing up. We would have to start so early. And there's this 1 mile, it was a logging road out at my parents' house where they logged it back when I was in middle school. So I was like, you know what? I've been talking about forever about let's clear it. And I want to, you know, be able to train out here for Pearl Jewel because the hills are great. So anyways, we got out there and we cleared it. And we were like, hey guys, if y'all want to come run out here, we got private property. There's no dogs, no kids, no crowds. Like, your car's not getting broken into. Come and check it out. We'll drink beer afterwards and hang out. And I think like the second time we had people out there, they were like, you should race. And we were like, oh, okay, yeah, sure, I guess. Like, well, we could do that. And, you know, we kicked around some ideas. John really loves the last man standing format. And it seemed to really suit what we had to work with, because a set distance out there just, you know, it's hard to sell a set distance on a 1 mile loop. It's just, it doesn't sound as fun. So, yeah.
Now, some people kind of like looped courses, but there are a lot of people that think that's just, that'd be hell on earth to have to run the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah. So the whole format made it really fun and interesting. And I looked and I didn't see anything exactly like that. There was no other last man standing that had a 20 minute time limit that was, you know, or last man standing that was that intense of a course or anything like that. So it was like a neat little, okay, maybe this is like the first time for something like that. We did something new. But, you know, we hosted the race. We had to do it under the guise of a wedding because of all the restrictions. Mm-hmm. You know, we were private property, so they wouldn't have been able to do anything necessarily. But, you know, at the time, still a whole hoopla. And the governor had made an executive order that you could have as many people as you want gather if it was a funeral or a wedding. And obviously, we didn't want anyone to die. So, our wedding it was, and our buddy was actually getting married anyways. And we were like up at Frozen Head running. I was talking to him about it. And he's like, you know what? We'll just go ahead and get hitched. You know, we call this whole thing like our reception. If that'll make your life easier, that'd be cool. We're like, yeah, that would be awesome. So, you know, I had like their marriage certificate on file. Like I had like the whole thing in place in case anyone came up. Like that was, we had wedding decorations. The guys ran in like little bow ties. We had a bride and groom tent. It was a lot of fun how we got around those whole, the COVID restrictions. Cause I think at the time you couldn't have more than like 15 or 20 people gathering. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, against whatever. So, you know, we had that great moment with Greg Armstrong and Dad and that last, well, Greg's like next to the last loop. And, you know, there's a video you can find on that. It's just, I think that's what pulled a lot of people in, because Jesse Itzler was there, him and Mark Brown, and Jesse was like going live and following Chad. And like people were just showing up to my parents' house to be like, hey, I saw this video on here. I follow Jesse Itzler. And then I realized this was like 45 minutes up the road from me. So I just figured I'd ride on out. It's crazy. Like people showing up. Jesse's just insta covering it. And, you know, it just really captured people's attention. I think that initial video within like 2 weeks had like 2 million hits.
Oh, wow.
It was really crazy. Yeah, it was nuts. The amount of people that reached out and, you know, it was really crazy. And, yeah, it really set the tone for like what we wanted to do and what we wanted to be involved with. And I'll say too, we couldn't have done it without our friends putting on that race. So much work from them and so much just dedication and clearing and planning. And you know, our friends at also RV were such a huge help in like telling us who to use and just a wealth of knowledge and resources. It was incredible. It was really a community effort, because from the time that we said we would host a race to race day, it was less than 3 months. So for a first-time event, you know, we started a race company in that time, started our LLC, and hosted the race. And coaching really came about, too, with everything shut down, because I had time. It's something I always wanted to do, and I think that that's something we fall into where, oh, that'd be really cool. I wish I could do that. And I always felt like, you know, despite my knowledge and despite my experience, like, I'm not a coach. Like, that's for people who win races and do this and do that. And I knew running coaches. I was friends with running coaches. But for some reason, it was just so next level that I was like, oh, I don't deserve to be one of those. Although for 3 years, I mentored the ultra running program that I had originally like done. So I spent 3 years training two groups of people to run ultras for like 3 years prior to that. But for whatever reason, I was like, oh, I'm not good enough.
It's amazing how we tell ourselves those kinds of stories, you know. It's like,
yeah,
despite the evidence.
Yeah, it really. I don't know why I put myself in that like little box of I just have to stay here and always want to do something and never move forward. And then, you know, with all the downtime, I finally had time to like do the certification and learn all the things. Also, you know, they changed how they did it. That was the other big drawback, was it was before any of the coaching stuff was online. You had to like travel and go to it and do a 3-day class. Mm-hmm. So that was the other thing. Not so much that I didn't want to, like, man, I don't want to take off 5 days worth of work and then have to go stay somewhere for 3 days on top of paying $600 for this course.
And hotel, you know, and food, and those things add up.
Yeah. And, you know, they'd sell out so quick. So I did spend like 2 years trying to plan to get certified. And then the United Endurance, they came out with, and then the initial one was an endurance certification for, you know, ultra running and all that. So I took that because that was online. And I was like, oh man, I can like do this stuff right here. Like, this is so great. And I don't have to travel. So that was kind of how it all got started, you know?
So what are some of the things that, that you kind of, is your, I guess, coaching philosophy for ultra runners, and you know, as far as training? And I mean, I think you kind of have a little bit of a different view than some of the other coaches out there. So what sets you apart as a coach?
Definitely a little bit different view. So many of the programs that are designed out there are, we refer to them from like a top down mentality. So, you know, it's a lot of stuff that works through road running or elites, and then it's just kind of tailored down to the normal person. Like, oh, well, normal people can't run 100-mile weeks or 80-mile weeks, so we'll just knock it down to 60 and you'll get the same benefits. And, you know, there's not enough strength training, and there's not enough, I think, it just individualized plans in that. So our philosophy appeals more from the base up and strength training. That's just, it's such a huge part of it. A lot of plans are just run to run, and we're a little bit more low mileage, targeted miles. Everything has a purpose, and incorporate strength training, you know. Okay. And not saying you have to get in the gym, you don't have to lift, but 3 days a week you need to strengthen your hips, your feet, your ankles, you know, your torso, things like that, that I don't think get stressed in a lot of other philosophies. There's a ton of coaches that also agree with me in that. Mm-hmm. Our big thing is longevity and sustainability. You know, there's this thought process in running, and I think it comes a lot from the road, that injuries are normal. Like, oh yeah, my knee should hurt, my hip should hurt. No, it shouldn't. If there is something happening, it's probably preventable. And if you look 6 inches either way on your body, you can probably figure out that there's an imbalance or a weakness there that's causing that problem. And if you would dedicate a little bit of extra time, you know, trade 5 miles here for an extra 45 minutes or hour in your week to lay on your floor and do clamshells or do some squats, that problem would probably go away.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, there's, I think, a real thing in the, or thought process in the running world, that injuries are badges of honor. You know, you hear runners sit around like, oh yeah, you know, when I had runner's knee, or when I had tendonitis, or when I had this.
Shin splints.
Like, well, you didn't have- yeah, you know, all of these things that are just so preventable in a sport that there's a lot you cannot prevent. So, you know, there's a lot of injuries that can come up that you have no control over. So why not, like, try to injury-proof your body, I guess.
Yeah. I read a statistic somewhere that they said that 85% of runners would experience, at any given year, 85% of runners would experience an injury, some sort of, and not from falling, but, I mean, an injury that is usually form-related, or, you know, there's, you know, some sort of breakdown because of the impact of running.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and it's the more miles you put underneath you, and if there's a little bit of a problem that you're ignoring or not treating, like, it's going to manifest into something a lot worse. That was the biggest thing that I did for Cruel Jewel this go around, was I really strength trained intentionally and purposefully. I realized I kind of ran out of time to train. There wasn't, you know, I typically recommend a 20-week block for someone running a 100-miler. Mm-hmm. It's a really good build-up, gives you lots of time. And I was like, oh, crap, I got, like, 2 months. I think I averaged for that race 15-mile weeks. You know, I didn't run a whole lot. We had a long run on Saturday we would typically do. I think I ran 40 miles once and 30 miles once in, like, the 3 months out from it. But everything else was, like, 6 miles and doing stair repeats. I did a lot of that, and getting on the stair mill and wearing bands and ankle weights when I work. You know, I clean houses, so I would wear bands either on my ankles or on my quads throughout my cleaning day, and there would be days where I'd wear ankle weights for, like, 8 hours.
Just walking around?
Yeah, just walking around and strengthening. You know, at first it would, like, really wear me out, and then, you know, it got to the point that it was like, okay, like, this is normal. I could feel, you know, strength building. And on some of the houses that were smaller, rather than using my mop when I mopped the floors, I would put, like, the mop rags on my feet, and I would, like, slide back and forth and do, like, hip exercises and stuff as I clean the floors. When I would scrub baseboards, I would get into a plank position. You know, I pretty much worked out throughout my entire day and strengthened my body while I was at work.
So I'm curious, you say bands on your legs. I mean, I was, like, envisioning this loop around your legs as you're walking around the house. Is that what you did?
Yeah, the resistance bands. I stayed in resistance bands. Like, my houses just thought it was the funniest thing watching me walk around like that.
Yeah, I'm trying to picture that. I'm trying to picture how that would look.
It slows down cleaning a little bit, I'm going to say. It makes it really hard to get around really speedy. But that was what I did for the 2 or 3 months leading up to the race. And like I said, I still only averaged 15 miles a week. But they were a lot of climbing, a long run, and then everything else was pretty much climbing miles that I did. Said I didn't log 100-mile weeks, and I have done that, say, you know, early in running when I was gearing up for Bigfoot. I've done multiple 100-mile weeks back to back, 120-mile weeks. I think the most I've ever ran is close to 140-mile week. Like, I've done it. I still feel better at the lower mileage. It does. I don't feel any stronger, and I didn't have any injuries. And after Cruel Jewel, I didn't have a single injury. I never, you know, even really felt a twinge or anything bad throughout that entire race. My body felt so strong and ready for all the hours of dynamic movement and having to balance that, you know, I didn't know that I had averaged such little running.
Well, and that, you know, the proof is there in your times. I mean, you said you were, in the past, you know, Bigfoot, you didn't, you know, you got 130 miles and had to stop. Cruel Jewel was you know, you were logging a lot of miles, and then with less miles, you actually did, you were on the podium. So that's a pretty good evidence for, like, yeah, the, you know, my philosophy on coaching and training is it will work.
Yeah. Well, and so, and even leading up to that, you know, I did a lot of heart rate training. That was like the biggest difference too. It was my first year of really doing long runs at a super low heart rate. I learned early on that we do our long runs way too fast. Yeah, I figured that out after my very first 50K. But I never really dove into any of the benefits of lower heart rate training. I don't, you know, I know that there's some programs that say, oh, you gotta, you know, train this much at low heart rate. And I think it's a really good tool. I don't think being married to that is for everyone. For most people, that's really hard to commit to. But it is part of my coaching philosophy. It's part of what we assign. I also train by it. You know, I took almost 50 minutes off my first 50K that I did by using heart rate training. I ran that same 50K like 2 or 3 years in a row. And all my friends are like, what have you been doing? Because I just flew through it. I whipped my friend's butt. Him and I ran together for a while. He was like, I got this rock in my shoe. I got to stop and get this out. And he was like, you were gone. You were wearing me out. And he's faster than me. He trains harder than me. You know, on any given day at a shorter distance, Keith would mop the floor with me. But the longer we go, my body could just maintain. And it was that low heart rate training, literally 45, almost 50 minutes off of my 50K time on that course.
That's a significant reduction in 50K, yeah.
Yeah, and it's the same course I ran that has 5,000-6,000 feet of elevation gain. And I think my best time on it prior to was like 6:30, and then I did it in 5:50. You know, I mean, it was, and still not doing high mileage, just hanging around 30 to 40 miles a week, my long runs, and another run during the week at a really low heart rate.
So for people who may not be familiar with low heart rate, kind of give a thumbnail sketch of what does low heart rate training, kind of the philosophy behind it?
You know, Maftone is the guy that's really famous for it, and he has tons of books. There's a whole training on it. So a little bit of it takes from that, you know, 80% of your training should be in an aerobic zone. But if you look at your little watch and or your like little breakdown on GPS, it'll tell you your aerobic zone is 130 to 155 or whatever. Well, that's like the threshold of your aerobic zone. That's a whole other thing. I don't need to get into the science of that. But in general, a good rule of thumb is below 130. It puts you in that, if you look at your watch, recovery zone or fat burning zone, that which is what you want to be in. It teaches your body to be more fat adapted. All ultra runners are fat adapted. Some people really, you know, jerk their chain about, oh, I'm fat adapted. Well, we all kind of are.
Yeah. you run that far, you're going to be burning fat, right?
Yeah. So I know that is some people's like specialty and how they identify, but training in that zone, and it makes you so much faster too. Your body's more adapted to using fat and utilizing oxygen. You know, you build your slow twitch muscles in that zone as well, because only at certain speeds and certain heart rates does that stuff get strengthened. And that's another thing, when we run too fast on our long runs, we're not strengthening. My thought process and, you know, philosophy on is, I'm not training for how you feel at mile 35 or 40. How are you going to feel at 85? What's going to be taxed at 80? We're going to train all of those things in these longer, slower runs. We also do walk training and hike training, because you can run 13-minute miles for however long, but at some point you're going to walk. And if your walk sucks and you're walking 22-minute miles when you could be walking 18, all those 13-minute miles are for nothing.
Yeah.
So that's another difference in what we do and how we coach, is you got to learn to go slow, you know, and if you don't have the patience to go slow for 3 hours, but you ain't got the patience to run a 30-hour 100 or a 20-hour, you know, that's another difference. Sorry, I'm like kind of jumping around, but another difference too in how a lot of the coaching philosophy, or how our coaching philosophy varies, is we are geared more towards that mid-pack runner. And what we do for the people that are running 25, 26, 30 hour hundreds, that training looks different than a 17 or 15 or 20 hour hundred. Mm-hmm. You know, those training philosophies are, the training application is very different. You know, we can train people for both, but a lot of these plans are geared towards that faster, mm-hmm. you know.
And the 17 hour, those people are, they have a, you know, if they're that kind of a time goal, you know, they're really pushing. I mean, there's a lot of things that go into that, and
yes,
it's
yeah, and
I know some people who have been new to the sport I've talked to who have set those kinds of goals for them for their first 100, and I'm just like, just finish. Just, I mean, it's better to go and just finish.
Just finish. Yeah. And, you know, it's great to set goals. I always, first 100, we're not going to have a time. We're just going to get the sucker done. And then we're going to assess how we feel and, like, what hurt. And that's so much of, you know, what we preach is just building a strong, resilient body so that when you get done, you are inspired by what you were able to do and what you just accomplished, not feeling like you just got run or drugged down the road and stomped on, wrapped back out. Like, you know, you just did something really cool. You should feel really good about that instead of being like, I barely freaking survived that, because I have barely freaking survived some hundreds. And it feels terrible.
Yeah.
So, you know, the goal is to not have someone feel that way, to have them look forward to the next one and feel like they can, you know, knock out a couple in a year. But, I can't remember what topic I was.
Well, that's kind of like, I try to make this like a virtual trail run, and this happens when you're on the trail and talking to somebody's like, what were we talking about? It's like, I had to catch my breath going up that hill. So, I did have a question that I wanted to ask you. I saw that you were rucking a little bit, and so something that I've kind of seen other people. I've seen a couple people who've talked about that. So, what was the thing that kind of sparked you with that? And can you tell a little bit of what that does for you?
So, you know, rucking, yet again, another thing that I've just always admired, people that rucked. I'm like, man, carrying all that weight around, look at you. I wish I could do that. Well, obviously I can, but I've never done it. And I first really kind of became enamored with it, like out at our buddy John Harden's races. And they're tough races. Black Toe's tough. Music City Trail Ultra's tough. And there would be ruckers out there. And I'm like, Jesus Christ, this trail is kicking my butt. And I am not even carrying weight. And there would, you know, be people out there carrying 30 pounds up to 50. I think there was one guy that did like 90 pounds once. It's insane. And, you know, Black Toe always gets gnarly. The worst thing about Black Toe is the weather. It's just always, I mean, it's wonderful, but it's always really crappy because it's so muddy and so wet. And it's at some points you can't even stay upright. And there are these ruckers going all night long, not complaining. Trail runners come in, everybody's like, oh my God, I'm falling. I can't even stand up. And here's these guys out here and women too, carrying 30, 40 pounds and not saying a word, just being positive. Trail runners are dropping like flies, like, oh, screw this. I'm getting in the car. I'm going home, going back to camp. And like, no, not the ruckers.
So is there a separate rucking?
There they are.
Is there a separate rucking division for the race?
Yeah.
Okay. So the trail runners and ruckers.
He allows rucks and has like. But yeah, that was like my real first exposure to it.
So is there like a separate category? Yeah, I mean, or do the ruckers have to compete head to head with the trail runners?
Oh no, they're separate categories.
They're separate. Okay.
They're separate categories.
Because wouldn't seem like that would be impressive if they could do it.
Yeah. Well, there was one guy out there this past weekend at Black Toe that had a ruck on that was like running. I don't know how much his ruck weighed. It could have been more than 20 pounds. I don't know. He's a tall guy, so maybe. But yeah, so I was kind of enamored with it and just thought it was really cool. And the attitude and spirit of those guys was just really unique. Well, John started rucking as he was getting ready for Chad's basic course. So he originally kind of got me into it because I'm also doing the basic course. And I was like, well, I guess I got to learn to carry this weight. Like, man, that's going to be tough out there because you carry anywhere from 30 to 50 pounds on your back for the entire weekend backpacking. And, well, I guess I should get used to it. And I realized afterwards, because we go and, you know, do the stairs and do the trails, and I stayed in that great heart rate zone, just that magical, like, right there where you want to be for training, and carrying the weight, having to do it the right way really made me engage my core and my glutes and just lots of climbing muscles, even just walking. Mm-hmm. So I was like, oh, man, okay, this makes you really strong, and this makes you, like, have to be efficient with what you do. So from a coach perspective, I was like, this is an interesting form of training here.
Did it cause you to modify your form? I mean, the way you moved as far as your position, you know, being more, you know, having a better posture and keeping your center of balance, you know, just keeping your weight centered over your feet.
Yeah, you really had to be cognizant of what you were doing and be aware, and, you know, not hunch over. Like, so the stairs that we run here in Nashville, you know, they're for a mile. It's, to get a mile, it's like 310 feet of elevation gain per mile, you know, and they go up to like a 14-15% grade. It's a really great climb. It's a great workout. And carrying a ruck on that, once you start to get to the top, you really have to work on your breathing and staying focused and making sure that you're climbing with your hips, as you should, your hips and your legs, like you should in running. Otherwise, you're hurting your back and you're hurting your waist, and, you know, you're hunching your shoulders over and you're huffing and puffing, and you don't get your diaphragm open and you can't suck in air like you should and belly breathe. So it really made me have to go, okay, am I up? Am I in a good position? Am I, like, how am I doing this? So, it was a great, like, little experiment. I love it.
Well, and I'm amazed if you can climb stairs without having your heart rate go sky high.
I'm still working on it, but, you know, breath work is another really important thing in running, and especially if you're doing a race that has a lot of climbing, like learning to control your heart rate and get to the point where, if you focus and really dedicate time to it, you can basically recover on really tough climbs. That was one of the benefits I had for me going into Cruel Jewel this year, was my heart rate wouldn't spike on climbs. It wouldn't matter how steep or how long it was. My breathing and my approach was so dialed in that I could get my heart rate to drop when I was climbing.
Wow.
So, but it took work, you know. I really had to focus on breath, and I did a lot of climbing and worked on being in tune with my body, as hippie and holistic as it sounds. You know, there's really something to it.
That does make a difference. So I guess I'm thinking what you're saying is that if you are not breathing properly and you're climbing a hill, that will cause your heart rate to spike, but you can have better control of it if you have proper breathing technique.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. But if you huff and puff and shallow breathe and do all that, you can actually do, our buddy Forrest out on the Murder Mile, he'll do like Lamaze breathing techniques and he'll get his breath back. It's really cool to watch. I've tried it on like the stairs and I was like, oh man, like that kind of works. Like, oh, I can breathe again. If, you know, you get kind of out of whack, mm-hmm. It's not a typical approach. I guess it's probably something that's not also taught in a lot of people's running philosophies, but
I'm trying to think, you know, some of the macho guys are like, no, I'm not, you know, I'm not doing Lamaze out there on the trail.
Yeah. But it works, you know. There's lots of different breathing techniques that you can use to either, they trigger your fight or flight response, but that triggers a whole nother wave of different chemicals, mm-hmm. and, you know, adrenaline and stuff that's all released. And that's what it is. You just learn to tap into what your body responds to and to control that, it's, you know, it's no different than any of those tools that they teach in the military and anything right. like that, where you learn to have power over your body or work with your body. I think that that's something that what we do is not necessarily natural, even though it is. We're the original OG endurance, you know, animals of the planet.
Yeah. But, yeah, that's true. And we're built, and we, you know, humans, like, humans are built for the, you know, the kind of running that we do.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think our lifestyle, it makes it so much of, like, we lose the ability to tap into that and to work with our bodies. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of just, that's what I'm really into right there, is how you learn to work with and not against your body. You know, a lot of people feel like they've got to beat it into submission and run so hard till, like, they just gotta do it until you drop. Like, well, if you drop, you, that's the opposite of what you want to do.
So do you do any kind of meditation or mindfulness work to kind of get that, you know, being in tune with your body, or just, is it something you do while you run?
Running is a lot of that for me, but in the mornings I like to meditate. I've gotten out of the habit here lately, but I think it's good to have a workout intention and a daily intention, something that, you know, you are mindful of throughout the day that helps to keep you focused. You know, little things like that really translate to running and to your goals if you integrate it into your day, where it's just it's just what you do, so that when you say something, that suddenly becomes your focus, you know, little things that remind you throughout the day. When I was getting ready for cruel, mindless things, and it was like a moving meditation, was I would go up to the track and I would do a couple miles, and on the straightaways I would close my eyes and visualize. I would visualize my highs, I'd visualize my lows, I would visualize, you know, if I rolled my ankle, how was I going to react? If this started to hurt, how was I going to move past that? You know, I kept myself seeing myself overcome things, but down the straightaways I'd close my eyes for like 10 seconds at a time. You know, it's a flat track, it's fine.
Yeah.
If you trip your eyes closed doing that, you probably shouldn't be on a trail.
No.
And maybe that sounds silly and it's unconventional, but I'm a big believer in visualization. So that was like meditation and visualization for me at the same time. So once I stepped foot onto that trail or a problem came up, like, I had already solved it so many times in my head. It never took any energy from me, because I was like, man, I've been here. This is fine. This is great. Like, I rolled that ankle 5 times already. We're fine.
Well, and I think, you know, with running being such a mental, I mean, taking so much of a mental energy and the mindset mm-hmm. piece, and I think a lot of runners don't really intentionally train. The mindset is kind of like, oh, I'll get that with my long runs, or, you know, there's not that kind of, you know, kind of intention that you put into that. So yeah, that was, I'm sure, led to your success. And visualization is another piece that sounds kind of woo woo to a lot of people, but there is something to that, to prepare, to pre-plan for what you're going to do when things don't go right.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's science. It does sound woo woo, but there is science that backs up how all your neuroelectric pathways can get rewired through visualization, because your brain actually does not know the difference between reality and a thought. Like, I mean, it just, you know, it is, but if you were to show your brain the exact same thing, like, it, you know, it absorbs it as the same way. Anyways, there's a little science on it, but I don't think that it gets talked about as much as it could, you know?
Yeah.
I think people, I think you're right, they're like, oh, I'll take care of that on my long run, or they let their daily habits and attitudes slip, and then they think that they're just going to have all this stuff dialed in on race day. And it's like, if you have a screw-it attitude or a negative attitude, if something happens and you don't immediately start going to problem solving, because that's all ultra running is, it is problem solving. And sometimes I'm not so good at that in my life where I stop and like listen. I just go, okay, well, how are we gonna solve this problem? We got a problem. Like, cool, we can sit here and talk about it, but I don't want to talk about it. I want to solve the problem.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, let's get up and do something.
Yeah, I'm like, cool, I understand that you have feelings. I understand that that makes you feel a certain way. We can't stop the world from that, so how are we going to solve it? How are we going to move forward? I need to be a better listener and not such a problem solver. But, you know, people that get on repeat with thoughts, feelings, or emotions, or don't initially problem solve, or their job is making other people problem solve, they lose that. And so race day comes and things start happening and they just freeze and they don't know what to do. You know, a lot of those stressful situations trigger our fight, flight, or freeze. And I feel like in order to be successful in ultra running, or for it to not be as traumatic, you've got to have a lot of, you know, fight response rather than, you know, quitting.
Yeah. Yeah. And the mental part can just wear you down. I mean,
People do not anticipate how much mental energy is used.
Yeah.
And I think that that's what gets people in a lot of the longer distances, is they just get so tired of having to put forth the mental energy. Physically, they're probably fine.
Mm-hmm.
Mentally, they're toast. Yeah.
I volunteered at an inaugural race by the Lawrence Trailhawks. They called it the Cactus Roulette, and there were three loops. It was a timed race, so you could sign up for 6, 12, or 24 hours. And they had a roulette wheel, and you spun the roulette wheel after each loop to see which loop you would do next. And that uncertainty and the chance, and they were, a couple of the trails were pretty tough. And it was like one of them is like, I still shudder. The reason I would question doing it is because I hate running on that section of trail, because it's I noticed that people would, you know, one guy rolled running on Cactus Ridge three times in a row, and that mental aspect of it was an interesting thing. And besides, you know, running loops and, you know, having to do anywhere between a 3 to 4 mile loop, each one of them. And so, yeah, it was that I got to kind of see that firsthand. And I was kind of thinking, I wonder, do I think I could do that? I don't know if I could do that. You know, I'm the mindset guy, you know, the mindset coach. We're talking about ultramarathon mindset. And I'm looking at that race going like, I don't, you know, besides I hate running Cactus Ridge. I mean, it's like that would be my worst nightmare, to be to roll Cactus Ridge, you know, four times in a row. that happens in every ultra. I mean, there's a place you get to where your mind is telling you, you know, let's just stop. We don't have to do this.
Oh, yeah. And I think that's where it really comes into play, your ability to compartmentalize. And, you know, for some people, just be okay. Like, I will say, I'm like, this is my life now. Like, it's fine. It's fine. It can be awful. It's not fine. But it's fine. But, you know, I practice that a lot, too. On our long runs, we would get with a group or, you know, have, and, you know, one person starts saying, so this has been hurting, or man, this sun is really hot, or like, God, this road is beating me up, because we do train a lot on roads, even though we race on trails. And, you know, I always make a point to never complain. That's one of my things, no matter what, no matter how easy it is. And there are days, as much as I love my friends, I'm like, in my head, I'm going, please stop complaining. Shut up. I don't need this negativity, because this sucks. Because there are days, especially training in those zero shoes on that road, it just sucks the life out of me. But I won't say a word until we get done. And it's so funny. We'll get in the car and I am just cussing up a storm and so dry. I'm like, God, that was awful. Oh my God, this hurts. And this was stupid. And that freaking rain. John's like, well, don't hold back. You didn't say any of that earlier. And I was like, because y'all are all complaining. I'm practicing my mental fortitude. I'm shutting up.
Well, that's,
but
and that's
in my good... head when everyone's like complaining. I'm like, yeah, that's totally true.
Well, and yeah, and if the things, it's, I think they think, I've heard this from a psychologist, the things that you focus on actually will be magnified. You know, that you,
absolutely.
You know, if you're focusing on how bad it is, you know, that becomes the primary thing, and it your brain makes it bigger than it is. And you can,
yeah, what is it, where focus goes, energy flows, or something like that?
I've heard that from, and that there's I think there are some science behind that as well. We kind of made that little meme out of it, a little saying that we can say, but it is true that that you can direct your energy by where you focus your attention.
Yeah, that's, there you go. I 100% agree with it, and that's said. I try to practice all of that even in training. That way, it's just second nature come race day.
Yeah.
So I can just bottle it up. Just goes fine.
So do you have anything on the schedule that you're looking forward to, or anything big, any exciting adventure that you've got coming up?
For me, I think I've got a pretty fun year. I've got Cruel Jewel 50, because that for the 50 they give you a belt, and for the 100 you get a buckle, and you can only wear those two things with each other. They're made for each other. You can't wear them with anything else.
Oh, okay.
So it'll be my second set that I would complete if I get this belt. So
so you got the buckle. And then so you have to come back and so you have to do the 50.
Belt.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, and if you run the 100, they don't give you the belt. You still have to come back and run the 50. So
that's kind of like a good marketing thing.
and it's super cruel, and I love it. So I want to come and complete my second set. And then I've got, I signed up for U-Ray 100 out in Colorado, and that'll be my first time going out there. I didn't get into hard rock, so I was like, okay, what can I do that's equally as hard or harder?
Well, yeah, U-Ray is up there as well. I mean, I it's like about, it starts at 10,000 feet and goes up just like hard rock, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, and it's 60,000 feet of elevation gain, I think.
Okay.
Total.
Okay, all above 10,000 feet in elevation. Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty gnarly from all the research and intel.
So have you run? I mean, and that's when you ran Bigfoot. That's not even close to that elevation. So have you run at elevation before?
No. You know, we got pretty high up. I did the Wonderland Trail around Mount Rainier. A couple years ago, maybe like 3 years ago, and that still didn't get up to 10. I think the highest we got there was like 8 or so.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I haven't done elevation, so it's going to be real interesting. I'm going to do some sauna training and breath work. Mm-hmm. That's going to be like my two big focuses.
Patrick McEwen has a book called The Oxygen Advantage, and has a method for training that you can train for altitude even at sea level. And it's called The Oxygen Advantage, Patrick McEwen. And it's designed for athletes. It's kind of breathwork training for athletes and different just exercises as well as talking about the science behind it, some of the things that you've mentioned already.
Oh, well, thanks. I'm going to have to check
that
out. That sounds like right up my alley when I need for that. See, I'm not going to get an oxygen tent. I'm not going to do any of that. Like,
yeah, and
some of the people I talk to, it's mainly learn to control your breathing if you have to train at sea level. But sorry,
And it's, for him, it is more controlling your adaptability to carbon dioxide. And
so it actually
will condition, you know, you get the same kind of increase in red blood cells that you do training at altitude, with his method. And so it's, you know, it's not just a psychological thing; it's also physiological.
I'm into that.
So yeah, that's a,
I'm
No, and I read his book first, and then there's another book on breathwork called Breath by James Nestor, and that's more. It still has some practical, but it's more of a memoir, and so it's kind of research. But I love. It's written really well. Both of those books talk about different breathing techniques and breath. The one by James Nestor is a little more scientific. Yeah, tends toward the scientific, but I thoroughly enjoyed reading both of those. And
I'll have to check that out. So, sounds like I have some reading to do, because I know it's going to be different for sure.
Yeah, it will. And I'm sure you could pick up some things that you could share with some of your athletes as well. I mean, from the Oxygen Advantage. I actually heard about it from a guy who's an online coach. Well, he's a coach and he's got a presence online, and he was talking about this breath work stuff, and that's how I found the book.
I'm a big believer in it.
Yeah. So I have before I go, I started this new thing. I'm calling these the bridge questions. Before I let anybody go, I have these three questions.
Who approaches the bridge of death must answer me these questions three. The other side he see.
Ask me the questions, bridge keeper. I'm not afraid.
All right.
What is a food that should be at every aid station? Not talking about the standard ones, but something that you would like to see at every aid station that may not be there.
Boost or Ensures, those are a secret weapon.
So what is Boost?
You know, the dietary supplement drinks.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Like the Boost and Short liquid calorie things. I mean, they're 8 ounces, and I think Boost actually has like dairy, so I think Ensure is non-dairy.
Okay.
But you know, they have up to 380 calories in them in 8 ounces.
Oh wow! Okay.
Yeah, it's saved my bacon during some races. You know, and it's full of carbs, full of protein. It's just full of everything that you need that you deplete your body of, that's in all those recovery drinks and all of that. Like, it's got a ton of it. That literally, I drank over 40 Boosts at that first Cruel Jewel. That was the only thing that kept me going.
And the other one was called Ensure?
Yeah, Ensure. There's a whole section of those like little drinks, and there's probably some like off-brand ones and mm-hmm. stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But, I see those used in a lot of 100-milers. Those are some great late mile calories.
So those are new to me. I've heard of Boost, but I don't know that I've ever seen them at any of the races I've been at. So that's all. I'll have to look those
up. Oh, they fit your hydration pack. They're great.
Okay, question number two. The weirdest thing that you've found or seen while you're out running on the trails?
Oh, I guess it depends on your definition of weird.
Well, your definition of weird.
I think some school buses off in the woods. That's kind of been, I'm like, man, I think those are like little meth shacks over there. But I think that's probably the weirdest, because what people do at all, I'm like, people are weird, that's fine, but sometimes how all those things got there is beyond me.
Okay, so. Yeah. Third question, a word or phrase that sums up your life philosophy?
Fuck. It applies to everything.
It applies to everything, okay.
Yep, okay. That'd be it.
I thought maybe you just were saying that to the question that you didn't like.
No, that'd be it.
Okay, that's a good one. Well, hey, thank you so much for being part of the show. Had a lot of fun talking with you. Oh, where can people
thank you.
Where can people get in touch with you?
You can follow me on Facebook, Becca MF Jones. I'm on Instagram at Lil Becca B. I also have another page with another coaching friend of mine. It's called Running Together. We have a ton of running information on there. You can also get in touch with us at bmfjevents.com. Okay. It's got all my coaching information, our event information, and contact info on there as well.
Okay. And the Running Together, is that an Instagram?
Yes, that's an Instagram. We also have a Facebook group. That one's a little bit more interactive. You know, people don't can't really do like group talks or anything on Instagram. It's kind of annoying. But so yeah, Instagram page that just has a lot of the information, and we repost it on the Facebook group as well.
Okay. So cool. Well, hey, thank you again for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. It's been great.
Hey, thank you for listening to this episode of the Ultramarathon Mindset Podcast. Becca has some good stories to share. I hope that you enjoyed it. If you do know somebody who would like to, you think might enjoy listening in on this conversation as well, take a minute and share the link with them. Also, if you like most of the episodes, tell other people about it. It helps me to grow the show, and it does help out our listenership. Remember, the show notes and for this show, as well as others, are at ultramindsetpodcast.run. You can also find a web player there for people if you have friends who don't really listen to podcasts regularly. You can go there and find a web player for all the episodes, and those as well as each individual episodes with the show notes. So if people don't listen to podcasts regularly and they want to listen to just one episode, they don't have to install a podcast player. They can play it directly from the website. Also, there's a place there for comments, questions, and stories. If you have running stories, you've got things that you have experienced out on the trail, would just like to make a short comment, that would be great. Just leave it there in the section for comments, questions, and stories. Also, if you have comments about the show or any questions you want to ask, that's what it's there for. And if you know somebody who is an ultramarathon runner, I've had a couple of guests who have come on as referrals from other listeners. So if you know somebody who can tell good stories and is good at talking, give them a go on to that same place at ultramindsetpodcast.run. Leave a comment and share their name with me. If you did, and as always, remember an ultramarathon mindset is about more than just running. It's about life. And I'm a life coach. If you're feeling stuck and you would like to see how coaching can help, send me a DM on Instagram at Eric Dieter, or use the link ultramindsetpodcast.run. Leave a voice message or text there. I'd be glad to see how I can help you out. Thanks again for listening. I'll see you next time.